I don't know for sure whether they woke him up because they thought that he could do something about their predicament, which they may very well have, or whether they just thought that the guy on whose word they were out here in the boat, in the dark, in the storm, ought to act like it mattered to him just a little bit that he was getting them all killed.
You'll want to be sure to catch the rest of Pastor Terry's message in just a moment. But first, we want to thank you for tuning in to the Indian Run Christian Church broadcast with pastor and author Terry Bailey. This broadcast is also produced as a free podcast, which you can find on iTunes or become a subscriber through our website. We'll have more information at the end of the broadcast, but for right now, let's join Pastor Terry as he preaches this insightful message.
How many of you love being caught outside in the rain? One or two, yeah. Personally, I've never reconciled myself to it. I've done it quite a bit. Anyone who has done any amount of camping knows what it is to be outdoors in the weather. And if you do the kind of camping that is my personal choice, which is kind of that primitive canoe camping thing, and you camp on an island in the middle of a river miles from anywhere, and the only way to cover those miles is to get in your canoe and do it, you find that when bad weather comes, your options for retreat are limited. You essentially have to ride out the storm. Now, on one of our trips, when I was accompanied by my sons, Andrew and Caleb, the storm wind started in the early afternoon and made several very nearly successful attempts to blow our tent off the island and into the river. We kept chasing it down and dragging it back. The sandy soil just would not hold the stakes. We finally had to go get some logs and put them on three sides of the tent and tie the tent to the logs to keep it where we wanted it. By the time we got in there trying to sleep in the tent after dark, the winds had really kicked up and added drenching rain, and unable to blow away because of the logs, the tent took to changing shape pretty profoundly. And I woke up in the wee hours and looked just a couple of feet away to where Caleb was with his head over in the one corner, and he had his hand on his head, his elbow up there to keep that pulsating smashed down tent surface from being right in his face so that he could kind of sleep. The storms took a break in the early morning hours, so we quickly loaded everything up and got into the canoe and took off. And even as we did so, we could see the next big bank of big, thick, dark clouds piling up to the north upstream of us. We were going downstream, of course, and with the current helping us out and paddling with fair vigor, we went several miles staying ahead of that storm, sunshine on our faces, pursuing darkness on our shoulders. And then the river took a big bend to the east. And that bend turned into an oxbow that ran to the northeast for about 4 miles before it looped back around, and we quit getting away from the storm. It spent a little time on our right hand, and then the further north we turned, the more we were headed directly into it. It reached us, big gust of wind, and then one momentary, very still, just quiet moment. And then it was like somebody up there upended a gazillion-gallon bucket. And it was just pouring down in sheets, and the wind kicked back up, blowing down the river, raised, the first time I've ever seen it, the White River of central Indiana, raised up in waves about 12, 18 inches high with little white caps. I realize in the ocean those would be small waves. When you're three guys in a canoe, that's plenty big, plenty big. And Caleb sitting on a cooler in the middle, sitting high, clutching white knuckle to the sides of the canoe, and Andrew and I paddling pretty hard just to keep from going backwards for a little time. And finally, the river bent back around to the south, and we began to run ahead of the wind. At that point, if we'd had a mast and a sail, I believe we could have kicked up a rooster tail behind behind the canoe, but even as it was, we made pretty good time to our getting out point once the river turned south again with that wind at our backs, but it seemed longer because of the cold, pelting, sheeting rain. My father met us at the public access point, and we put all our stuff in his truck, and we drove to the Wendy's in Washington, Indiana. And at the Wendy's, the three of us did two things. First, each of us ate two hot value meals. And second, we kept taking turns going into the men's bathroom and running the hot air hand dryer until that little safety filament swole up and shut the thing down so that we couldn't blow hot air on our soaking wet clothes anymore. Two observations. First, our little predicament was more in the line of discomfort than danger. And I'm fine by that. I'm going to tell you with complete honesty. I have seen those movies on TV where people are out in the middle of the ocean and on this boat in some big, tremendous storm. I have seen those scenes, and never once have I had the thought, man, I wish I was there. Not my kind of thing. So I'm fine by discomfort instead of danger. But even given that, I will tell you that on the occasion, I would have paid more than a nickel if I could have pointed my finger at that summertime Indiana thunderstorm and said, hey, knock it off! And have it pay attention to me. So Jesus had just finished a big teaching session in which he used several parables to represent what the kingdom is like. Now, he had also done a considerable amount of healing, but the last thing in that day was the teaching that he gave to the assembled multitude. And then, Mark says, on the same day, at the ending of that same day, Jesus says to his disciples, into the boat, guys! We're going to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. Now, the Sea of Galilee is really only a large lake, but it's large enough that the disciples could not see the shore opposite Capernaum. And the point we want to get is that what Jesus suggested wasn't like just a little rowboat jaunt on the lake down at Salt Fork. This was a larger, more serious undertaking. Nevertheless, because Jesus said so, Mark says they took him into the boat just as he was. That is to say, with dark coming on, they got in wearing what they were wearing and took nothing that wasn't already there. No extra provisions made. I think Jesus intended to get to another place, spread the message farther afield. But some of the people were so taken with him that they wanted to go with him and hear more of his teaching. They got into their own boats, or some of them may already have been in boats. Some scholars say that in a large crowd on the shore of the Sea of Galilee, it may have been possible to get closer to Jesus in a boat from the water than on land after a while. But however that may be, other people got in their boats and they were going to follow Jesus. We don't know how many of those boats stuck with him. They are not specifically mentioned later in Mark's account, unless the term disciples is intended to cover more territory than just the 12 in the one boat. And maybe a lot of those people, once the sun set and they saw that Jesus meant to cross the entire lake rather than just go down the shore to some secluded cove where they might stay for the night, maybe a lot of them thought better of it and turned back. But at least the boat that Jesus and the 12 were in kept going. Maybe some of the others did as well. It's either the disciples in the boat or the disciples in the boats, and the reader gets to decide. And the storm kicked up. Sea of Galilee is infamous for sudden storms. I have not been there and seen it with my own eyes. It's my understanding it doesn't even have to be raining. The lake is surrounded on about two-thirds of its perimeter by highlands, which are crisscrossed with steep, narrow ravines which carry the water down from the high ground to the surface of the lake, but which also serve to channel and amplify the winds that come down off the high ground. And those winds erupt from those canyons and form the core of storms that rise suddenly And this storm rose suddenly. And the waves grew until the water was pouring over the bow of the boat, threatening to swamp and take down all on board. The disciples, some of whom are experienced boaters on this very lake, are doing everything they can do, but they recognize they are in trouble. Sometimes in the midst of a crisis, we reach that point where it suddenly occurs to us, we may not make it. And they reach that point. In fact, they thought, we surely aren't going to make it. This is it. At least there was comfort in sharing the misery and the terror with all your friends and buddies in the boat, sharing it with all of them but one. You couldn't share it with Jesus. You know why? Because he was asleep, believe it or not. He was back there in the stern with his pillow and blankie, calmly snoring away. Whoever had the helm probably had to loom over Jesus' recumbent body, and that person was sweating bullets with tension and exertion, and Jesus was just sleeping. What do you do in such a strait? Well, obviously, you wake Jesus up. And I don't know for sure whether they woke him up because they thought that he could do something about their predicament, which they may very well have, or whether they just thought that the guy on whose word they were out here in the boat, in the dark, in the storm, ought to act like it mattered to him just a little bit that he was getting them all killed. Interpreters have taken the disciples' words both ways. Don't you care? Don't you care that we are about to die? And Jesus got up. And I think the word that Mark chooses for framing Jesus' response is so interesting. It says, he rebuked the wind. You know, we've all been there. In one sense or another, how many of you have stubbed your bare toe on a rock or some other hard surface? And though you knew it made no sense, whether this was the exact wording or not, said, stupid rock! Rock is not stupid. Maybe we're stupid for walking around rocks in bare feet. And the rock didn't care. I guarantee you the rock did not later whine to its butt. I don't know why he was so mad at me. I was just sitting there minding my head. And he kicked me! And, yeah, that's that. I have felt a time or two like rebuking the wind. Like when I was trying to carry 4x8 sheets of plywood on some nice breezy day. Or trying to fold up a humongous tarp on some windy day. Or trying to gather up the weed barrier from the watermelon beds on some windy day, and it's taken 10 times longer than it needs to be, and you have to run and fetch heavy stuff to lay on things and so forth and so on. And after a while, you just feel like shouting to the wind, can't you give me a break? We've said things like that. Somehow that's not the way I take Jesus' words. First, because when he rebuked the wind, wind stopped. And I'm not trying particularly to make out like the wind is a living thing with intentions. But I do think this. All the destructive forces that are active on this planet are the result of the curse that fell because of our sin. I do not believe that the planet as God designed it in its first days had tornadoes or hurricanes or earthquakes or volcanic eruptions or any such things. I think that the flood of Noah was not only the greatest flood to that date or after it for that matter, but I think it was probably the first flood ever. I think there is pretty good biblical evidence for thinking it was the first time that it rained ever. And so I regard this storm that terrified the disciples as just another aspect of the destructive fury unleashed when we placed our home under the dominion of evil. And one reason I chose the Mosey Lister song, "Till the Storm Passes By," is because I share her view that in the world to come, destructive weather and all similar catastrophes will completely disappear. And Jesus, who knows how, when, and how completely our world was broken, and what the world to come will be like, rebuked the wind. "Hush. Be still." I bet Caleb would like to have Jesus visit children's church some days. "Hush. Be still." And then he said to the disciples, either in the boat or in the boats, "Why were you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" A lot of meaning in one word there, "still." Do you still have no faith? Let me tell you what's been going on here. Jesus can say, "You have seen me heal the sick. You watched when I did it. You have seen me cast out demons. You were right there when I did it. You heard what the demons said, and you saw how completely subject to my command they were. You've heard every word I have ever taught. You were right there with me all this time, and you still have no faith." And the response of the disciples, either in the boat or in the boats, and in this some interpreters think they see evidence for "in the boats" with an S, because their response is, much as they had been afraid of the storm, they are suddenly even more afraid of Jesus. Very afraid, Mark says, and they began to whisper and murmur among themselves, "Who then is this guy that even the winds and the seas obey him?" Who is this guy with whom we are currently confined in a small boat on the big water far from help? See, because the kind of guy who can stop a major storm just like that with just his word may not always be the safest kind of guy to be. It's like, yeah, I'm glad that storm quit, but what if he says to my heart, "Hush. Be still"? Will my heart obey as surely as the winds and the waves did? There is something here. We have been discussing in our Sunday evening Bible study group that whole business that I've mentioned about the demons crying out that Jesus is the Holy One of God, and Jesus making the demons shut up, and Jesus doing the same sort of thing with some of the people that he healed. "Look, I'm going to heal you, but don't tell anybody, okay?" Did Jesus not want the word to get out? Some in our discussion group think, well, it was already too late for that. Cat's out of the bag. Can't stuff it back in. Perhaps. Let me tell you something about human beings, and when I say it, you will know from your own experience that it's true. Hearing something, and even repeating something, is not always the same thing as realizing something. Yes, they had seen Jesus heal lepers, and make paralytics walk, and cast out demons, and teach with authority and wisdom unheard of. All true. But here they are, standing in the calm where a storm just was, finally beginning to register what such things might really mean, and asking, "Who is this guy? The one we've been hanging about with for months now. Who is he that even the elemental forces of the planet are subject to his command?" I said it earlier, but I purposely passed over it quickly. On the day that they got into the boat and set off across the lake, Jesus had just finished teaching a series of parables about the nature of the kingdom. And I think that the disciples heard it but they didn't get it. Most simply put, the kingdom is that territory that is under the authority of the king. Just that simple. If it's under the authority of the king, it's in the kingdom. Holy smokes. If his kingdom includes sickness and demons and the elemental forces of the whole world, if all these things are subject to his authority, where does his kingdom end? And the answer is, it does not. In scope, in duration, in intensity, kingdom of God is infinite. And there are reasons why, when he spoke in advance about Jesus Christ in chapter 9, verse 7, the prophet Isaiah said, there will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace. They finally begin to get it. And for sinful men, it's a little bit scary. And we are no different. We have seen and heard plenty enough to know a great deal, and yet it may often appropriately enough be asked of us, why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith? And when it finally strikes us what it means to say that he is the Lord of heaven and earth, the Lord of all creation, that before it's done, every knee is going to bow to him and every single tongue will confess to the glory of God the Father that he is absolute, uncontested Lord, that he is the King of all, that my life is his to spend any way he sees fit because he is the King and I am subject to his authority. It scares us just a little and sometimes a lot when it suddenly becomes plain that this Christianity thing that we belong to is not a social club or a self-help group or a mutual admiration society where we sit around reassuring each other with how superior we are to the world in general. This is the kingdom of God. And he is the king. And I am not. And I am ultimately, absolutely, completely subject to his all-compelling, absolute authority, which will have no end. Oh, this is a good thing, because God is good. But that doesn't mean it isn't scary for us when we first begin to realize it. Nevertheless, let us cease our games and enter the kingdom.
We want to take a moment to thank all of you, our listeners, for setting aside time each week for the Indian Run Christian Church broadcast on this station. You can find out more about the church with a quick visit to our website at www.christforeastcanton.com. On behalf of Pastor Terry and all the folks at Indian Run Christian Church, I pray God's blessing on you and your family.